honored to have with us Professor Rita Mostafai, who will be speaking on Rousseau today. And before we get started, I'd ask that you turn off your cell phone ringers so that they don't interrupt our conversation. Professor Mostafai, as most of you know, is associate professor and associate professor of French, and also the chair of Romance Languages and Literatures here at Boston College. Her PhD and MA are from the New York University, and she has a licence de lettres from the University of Paris, the Sorbonne Nouvelle. Fields of research include 18th century French literature, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, as we'll hear today, strategies of reading and censorship. With regard to her subject today, she's the author of Le Citoyen de Genève et la République des Lettres, 2003, and co-editor of two books on Rousseau, Rousseau and L'Infâme, Religion, Toleration, and Fanaticism, The Age of the Enlightenment, and approaches to teaching Rousseau's Confessions and Reveries. She's a past president of the Rousseau Society, the Rousseau Association, and last year she was honored by the French National Ministry of Education with the award of Chevalier, or Knight, in the Order Ordre des Palmes Académiques, which is a wonderful honor. And perhaps most importantly and triumphantly, she's also a member of the Boisy Center's Board of Advisors. We are delighted for all of these reasons to have her today and look forward to hearing your talk on Rousseau's paradoxical legacy. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Eric, and thank you to Eric and Alan Wolf, both of them, for having the Boisy Center be a resource for us all. It's now become a place that I've really enjoyed visiting, and it has really contributed, I think, very significantly to the intellectual life on campus. So I'm delighted and honored to be invited to talk a little bit about the project that I'm currently working on Rousseau. So I've titled this talk Rousseau's Paradoxical Legacy, and I've chosen a painting to illustrate it. I'll show you some more images at the end of the talk, just because I think the visuals help when you talk about the Enlightenment, which is also a very visual culture. And this painting, which I will discuss later, shows Rousseau in Armenian garb. This is actually what you see here is an Armenian dress with a fur hat and a fur collar, which Rousseau began to wear while in exile at Moutier in the territories that were under the jurisdiction of Frederick II of Prussia, following his exile from France as a consequence of the banning of his works. Émile, first in Paris, and then Émile and the Social Contract, in virtually every major capital in Europe, continental Europe, with the exception of England. And this is where London is, where this portrait was actually commissioned by David Hume, who had given hospitality to Rousseau. This is 1766. And David Hume had Alan Ramsay, famous royal painter, attached to the king of the court of George III, paint this. And this is a very important portrait because it captures a moment of Rousseau's life while he was in exile, really a celebrity in exile. He was well known as the writer fugitive of his day, had to flee, from place to place. But it also became, and we will see that, I'll show you the pictures later, it also became, paradoxically, the most famous representation of Rousseau in his lifetime. And so this is something that's quite interesting. So I wanted then to talk a little bit about, to provide a sort of reassessment of Rousseau's career, which is not just a literary career. That's also a part of what's interesting about this, but the career of what are called men of letters in the Enlightenment. And letters in the Enlightenment really does not mean what we think of letters today, but they mean every field of inquiry, arts, sciences, music, every field, ranging from aesthetic to the sciences, and including, of course, politics, as we will see. And in particular, what I'm interested in is working on this, what was really a remarkable rise from obscurity to fame, which Rousseau, I think, provides both an unusual example, but also a kind of representative model, which will become extraordinarily important, especially for the generation of romantic writers but for all the writers in the 19th century in particular. And we, in order to do this, you have to focus and keep in mind the paradoxical reception of Rousseau's works, because that's at the heart of the problem. This, the, what I call this paradoxical reception is that, and we'll talk a little bit about it, it's a reception that brought him both celebrity, but also marginality, and we'll talk a little bit about that, and made him into, you know, a new figure of fame in the Republic of Letters, which, you know, predicated on a new and original relationship between the writer and his public. In particular, the public now, that when we talk about Rousseau's reception, is no longer limited to the readers of his books, but the public now encompasses everyone who's heard of Jean-Jacques Rousseau. So when we talk in discussions of literacy, oftentimes, you know, in the classroom, we talk about the Enlightenment and the fact that very few people knew how to read and write. This has always been a point of puzzlement for historians, of intellectual historians, historians of ideas, is to measure the impact of books on a society in which very few people have a direct access to books. Well, what I think we need to understand, because we don't really know oral cultures in a way that, that we need to understand them, is that we shouldn't think too narrowly of a book's impact on the public in terms of who has actually read and understood the book. Very few people read The Social Contract. It's clear. It's a very difficult book to read. It's very dry. But everyone had heard of it. Well, not only that, but they, people may not have read the book, but they had perhaps read excerpts in the gazettes and the newspapers and the periodicals, which were circulated, broadly disseminated throughout Europe, including in the rural areas, where even if you didn't know how to read, perhaps, you know, it had been read aloud at some public assembly. So I think these are some of the interesting questions. I think that this notion of fame and celebrity surrounding the you know, the works of an author brings for us in the 21st century. So one of the claims I make in my work is that the at the center of Rousseau's reception here is a new form, a new celebrity status that Rousseau inaugurates. And in particular, it has to do with something that is documented, which is a gradual emergence of the public persona of the author. But Rousseau is a very important case study and an important example of this phenomenon, which will then, of course, go well beyond Rousseau as a person. So what we find here is a new curiosity, which is, I think, familiar to us today, because that's how we understand celebrity, a new curiosity about the private lives of the author. And, you know, an eagerness for the knowledge of the person behind the writing. Now, we take that for granted today, but this actually begins with Rousseau. And it's with Rousseau that this phrase is used for the first time, that linking the life and conduct of the author, an interest in, you know, in not just reading Jean-Jacques Rousseau, but, you know, inquiring about the life and conduct of Jean-Jacques Rousseau. As an example, I will cite this anecdote, which is, it's one anecdote, but there are many other examples that support it. Returning from his exile, returning from his exile from England in 1770, you know, in a decade, in the 70s, Rousseau comes back to Paris, and now he's extremely well known. And there are scenes, actually, sort of almost rioting scenes, where people rush to the cafes to see him because he is known to play chess. He's a very good chess player. So here's what a document that says that this is taken from a correspondence. So people were asked, "What are you doing here?" And you know, I'm paraphrasing from the French here. So they would answer that it is to see Jean-Jacques, c'est pour voir Jean-Jacques, and you notice that he's referred to by his first name. So they said, but who is Jean-Jacques? And they would answer, I'll read it in French. On lui demandait ce que c'était Jean-Jacques, elle répondait qu'elle n'en savait rien, mais qu'il allait passer. So the message, we don't know, but we know he's coming. And so, and this is, but there are numerous examples. I mean, in the newspapers, in the Gazette in London, for example, they document John James Rousseau, you know, and the famous famous writer. And so what it is, I think, the reason I'm focusing on this notion of celebrity is because we have, I think, something that a real shift here in the definition of this new understanding of celebrity as distinct from, you know, from notions of reputation or glory or even fame. Celebrity is now the privilege of being known by people who don't know you. You know, I think we all know that's a modern definition of celebrity, right? You all think you know Madonna, and, you know, even if you don't know her. So you know, so then celebrity, this kind of celebrity, is a form of notoriety, you know, in which, in this case, a person, an author, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, is well known during his lifetime by people who don't know him, but who may want to identify with him or not, you know, as the case may be. And in particular, I think it's clear that this new mode of social recognition that crystallizes around the person of Rousseau appeared at the end of the 18th century. It is, you know, it can be seen as a consequence of major social and cultural shifts, which, you know, again, are well documented, and I will just, you know, mention them. The growth of publishing, where, you know, books are now even more widely read and disseminated, and books now have acquired a real mass market, with the phenomenon of bestsellers, you know, first witnessed in the 18th century. The rise of literacy, which is rising, you know, despite the fact that it's still not affecting majority of the population. And also the development of newspapers, gazettes, and of course this phenomenon will obviously expand during the French Revolution with the freeing of the press. But of course, this phenomenon of celebrity brought about a number of results, some of which were unexpected. You know, and I think Rousseau is an example of that, because writers now had to come to terms with the expectations of their readers and admirers, and both admirers and detractors, readers who write to authors, and this is a phenomenon perhaps which it's maybe on the wane now, although with blogs I guess it's sort of being revived, but readers don't just read books, they actually write to the authors. They sometimes demand, you know, a certain accounting. So I think that we all know that the century of the Enlightenment is often presented as, you know, the time of when public opinion, modern public opinion, is born, but it's also, you know, the birth, it's also the time that witnesses the birth of the first celebrities. Celebrities in the modern sense. Of course, the, you know, the figures that used to enjoy the public, you know, image were the images, the figures, of course, of the king and the aristocrats, and we'll see some of that example. So it's the displacement of prestige from the aristocracy and the royal family onto these new types of persons that great writers have become, the great writers which will now have as part of their kind of lot and their profession, you know, visits and pilgrimages from their readers, as well as daily letters. Now, another aspect of this, you know, interesting, you know, something that needs to be talked about for Jean-Jacques Rousseau, that I think without which we can't really understand why, you know, I talk about paradoxical celebrity, is the fact that Rousseau, unlike many of his contemporaries, insisted on publishing works with his name on the title page. Now, this was not the common procedure for writers at the time, for a number of reasons, I think, as you know, and that in Ancien Régime France, publishing a book was not considered a right. It was actually called a privilege in every sense of the word. Privilege means it's a law, it's a certain distinction that you actually have to earn or pay for. So privilege is what a bookseller pays for, the right given, granted by the king, to publish a work. And typically what would happen in the Ancien Régime is that an author would actually either give or sell his manuscript to a bookseller and basically relinquish all rights, because there are no copyrights. The bookseller would then publish the work, and if you wanted to do it legally, you would seek the privilege of permission from the royal censor, and you'd have to pay for it. So as an example of this, the Encyclopédie Diderot and d'Alembert's Encyclopédie was published with the royal privilege, a very costly and also prestigious status. Nevertheless, it didn't prevent the work from being banned and censored. So even that did not protect you, because the king actually did not have absolute power over the policing of books. And in the policing of books in the 18th century, it is an extraordinarily complex activity that pits together all sorts of bodies with conflicting claims. You could say that no less than four major bodies, and that's only the four major ones, could intervene in the legislation regarding books: the Royal State Council, so that's the King's Council; the Parliament of Paris, which tended to side with the Jansenists, and they were often in conflict with the King, often exiled, by the King; the Sorbonne, that's the Faculty of Theology of the university; and the Archdiocese of Paris, who had there was a very flamboyant Archbishop, Christophe de Beaumont, who was well known for stirring trouble, and occasionally he would be exiled too. So I think when you study the Ancien Régime, I think it's a mistake to think that you have the philosophe on one side and then the royal powers on the other. I think it's a very interesting and extremely complex situation. So in the case of Émile and the social contract which led to this particular situation, what's interesting is that what you need to know is that the social contract was published in Amsterdam in April 1762. Amsterdam is where Rousseau had a relationship with a publisher who was also a Genevan-born citizen like himself, Marc-Michel Ray. And it is with Marc-Michel Ray that Rousseau published most of his works. At the same time, Émile, Rousseau's treatise on education, was published in Paris in late May 1762. And despite assurances that Rousseau received from Malesherbes, the director of the librairie, so really the person in charge of the books in Paris, the book was banned immediately after it appeared. So by June 7th of 1762, the book was denounced as heretical by the Faculty of Theology of the Sorbonne. On June 9th, the Parliament of Paris, not to be outdone by the Sorbonne, issued a decree against the book, ordering it to be burned, and the tradition was that the books were all burned on the steps of that big staircase leading to the Parliament. So that staircase no longer exists, but it still does in the text. So that on that day, on June 9th, urged by his friends and protectors, and by then he had very powerful patrons, but who could not even prevent this kind of action against him. Rousseau fled from Montmorency, where he had taken residence under the auspices of the Duke of Luxembourg. And he fled, a couple of days later, the book Émile was also burned in Geneva. And in rapid succession, in Holland, in Bern, in Neuchâtel, just to give you an idea of how this controversy, the role that this controversy played here in the reception of the works, this continued. On August 20th, the Sorbonne issued a 352 censoring report, 352-page report, censoring 45 pages of Émile. So, this is a practice that I think we have maybe forgotten, but the practice of censorship in Ancien Régime does not actually mean just slashing and burning books. It actually refers to it's a type of gloss, of paraphrasing, and what it is really is a commentary on the work, which sometimes, as you can see, even exceeds the dimension of the work. So within a year, then, you had The Citizen of Geneva, now famous for having published first discourse crowned by the Academy of Dijon, a second discourse on the origins of inequality, which was not crowned by the Academy, but which had an enormous influence throughout Europe, author of a major novel, Julie ou la Nouvelle Héloïse, arguably the first bestseller in modern times. Now, that author found himself in exile, and he renounced his Genevan citizenship in 1763. And for several years was sort of, the vagabond in exile until he found himself in London. So what's interesting here is that paradoxically, it is because of the banning of his books and his forced exile, as well as the numerous public debates that ensued these events, that Rousseau found really this new form of celebrity and recognition. Because people, not only were these official texts written against him, the condemnation decrees, but then the public took side. The public participated in these debates. And so you have, and this is well documented in the archives, these dramatic events were immediately and broadly publicized throughout Europe, with gazettes and newspapers publishing daily news of the affair. I mean, you can't read a single newspaper without hearing about Rousseau. Every day they give you an update on where is Rousseau. And as well, and the other thing too is that the publicity surrounding the affair is an interesting phenomenon of publishing in the 18th century, because it is not just, gossiping, and some of it is gossiping about what, Rousseau's, appearances, but it's also reprinting all the condemnation decrees so that these texts themselves also become part of the reception of Rousseau, and actually also in the binding and publishing practices of the time, sometimes they are published with the work, so that you read Émile, and then you get the various texts of condemnation against him. So a reader would not be reading just Émile, but would be reading the work of a writer that is in exile and condemned by texts that he can also read. So this publicity then given to the political and religious scandal, given by the press then to this scandal, really, literally a scandal, transformed the events into a lucrative printing venture. Because that's also what's at stake here, is that this actually sells books. Burning books, is a good way for to encourage the kind of interest. And this transformed the case of Jean-Jacques Rousseau into a cause célèbre. And then, as I argued, these events were also instrumental in the development of a new concept of authorship based now on a paradoxical relationship between singularity, which is what the most common word associated with Rousseau, and this is in every language, in English, in French, in German, everyone talks about how singular he is. He is singular in the way he looks, his dress, in his ideas, in his thesis. So singularity, but at the same time, exemplarity. So I'm working now on this idea of the shift between singularity and exemplarity. So just a little bit quickly, because I think we can maybe take this up during the question period. In terms of methodology, when you work on Rousseau, and as I do, and you work on these issues, what you realize in a way is that you're confronted with a problem of understanding exactly what you're working on. And there are actually several figures of Rousseau that come into play that really need to be, on the one hand, need to be separated, but need to be integrated within one another. So just perhaps to summarize this, I can say that there are really three figures of Rousseau that I'm interested in. The first figure is the figure of of Rousseau as the man of letters of in his day, in his society, as we can reconstruct it through archival documents. So this would be sort of close to the real Rousseau, but with the caveat that it's very difficult to, you know, this is a reconstruction of, you know, the career of a man of letters in the 18th century. So that's the first figure. The second figure is a figure that is a textual figure. That is the figure of the writer as it is constructed in the works. And in Rousseau, it's extremely important because it's both in the text and also in the paratextual materials that surround the text, the prefaces, the title pages. And it's really looking at the ways in which Rousseau constructs a textual image of himself. And then the third Rousseau, equally important, is that you could call the imaginary Rousseau. And that's the persona that is invented by the readers, you know, that persona which is you know, neither false nor true, but it's an imaginary figure which belongs also to the reception. So as an example of why I believe that no serious work on Rousseau's reception can really fail to view these three figures and analyze them simultaneously in order to, you know, to understand this process of reception, I'll give one example, and the question of religion, just I think, but the same could be said for politics or other. I'll just focus on religion here, because I see that we have very little time. For example, when it comes to religion, Rousseau is obviously, as we know, the author of extremely important books that present original theses on natural religion, a critique of revealed religion, and a critique of fanaticism and intolerance. So yes, there is a body of works in which Rousseau deals with the question of religion. However, I don't think you can really understand the impact that Rousseau had on, you know, the formulation of religious ideas in the Enlightenment if you also don't look at the other two dimensions, the real and the imaginary. So the textual dimension is insufficient because at the level of what I call the real here with, quotation marks, the historic reference, you know, that we can reconstruct, it is clear that you need to also take into account what is known and what was known to Rousseau's contemporaries about his own relationship to his religion. Because Rousseau was known to be a Protestant from Geneva who had first converted to Catholicism, you know, upon entering French territory at the beginning of his career, and who had then later returned, had been reinstated to Protestantism. And this was, of course, was surrounded by a number of public debates. And therefore, the author then of Émile and these texts on religion and in particular the critique of miracles and the insistence on receiving the Gospels freely, this has to also be, circumscribed within this the question of all the events surrounding the public discourse on Rousseau's religion. In addition, you need to also take into account the imaginary dimension of this portrayal of religion, and in particular, in Émile, in the Profession of Faith of the Savoyard Vicar, it's important to understand, you know, how this imaginary representation of Rousseau and himself, and the way he debates this question of what it means to be in a religion, out of a religion, and expelled and reinserted into one. So these are some of the examples. And I will then just end this by saying that what I'm trying to demonstrate, or rather one of the premises of my work, is that Rousseau's influence, so his legacy, cannot be measured only on the basis of his discursive positions, on the thesis, only on the basis of his ideas, not that those don't matter. That the Rousseau's discourses are accompanied by non-discursive elements which are just as important, I think, for us to understand. These elements are, you know, gestures, conduct, behaviors, comportement, which themselves, just you know, just as the ideas do, they also are debated in the public sphere. So, so for example, among the discussions that are held around the conduct of Rousseau, and discussed extensively throughout his lifetime and I think and beyond, are the fact that he rejects, you know, the common forms of patronage, you know, which had been traditionally accepted in the Enlightenment. It is well known, for example, that following his successes with his opera, The Village Soothsayer, he refused a royal pension, and that will continue, you know, throughout his career. You will see that there's an entire discussion on the way that he tries to negotiate a certain claim for independence and the necessity for protection, which is real. In addition, the way that he refuses the social and literary conventions of his days. We talked about the fact, you know, putting his name on the title page, the way he dresses, the way that he refuses to wear wigs, and his rejection also of the status of philosopher. All of those, which now literary criticism calls postures. Actually, there's a term used in France. It's called scénographie auctoriale, which is very difficult to translate. I'm not sure, but it's about this basically this process of putting your, you know, staging your own, you know, reception. So and so the claim then is this new mode of presentation, self-fashioning, which will become inseparable from the notion of the modern writer. So I'll stop here.
Do you want to show some?
Yes, and I brought some images because I think we might find it. So I pressed every button.
Yeah.
Okay. No. Okay. So this is a portrait, and so this is what from 1767, and. Just to tell you what I think is interesting about the portrait is, you know, the gesture, you see this, the hand gesture with the index finger pointing towards his heart, of course, refers to the fact that at the time in 1766, it is well known that Rousseau is writing his memoirs. They will be, of course, published under the title Confessions, but at the time, it's already well known, it's already the object of a lot of speculation. David Hume, in a letter to the Comtesse de Boufflers, who is one of Rousseau's protectors, says something interesting. He intends to draw his own picture in its true colors, and adding at the same time, I believe that nobody knows himself less. this is simply a self-portrait of Rembrandt from the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum to show you that, you know, Ramsay draws on that tradition of the self-portrait, except now this is a portrait of a writer who wants to write his self-portrait in his writing. So it's kind of subverting the tradition. Now, this is the companion portrait to the what was already originally conceived as a diptych. Alan Ramsay was commissioned to paint both Rousseau and David Hume at a time when both David Hume and Alan Ramsay are Scots. David Hume is trying to establish himself as a writer, and he is actually vying for a royal pension from the king, for himself and for Rousseau. Of course, this will become a disaster because Rousseau will be furious at the fact that David Hume is trying to get him a pension, and a dispute will ensue. But what's interesting is that the king did not much care for the dress. He thought that the portrait was very overdone. And in an anecdote related by James Boswell, there are a lot of anecdotes in the 18th century, but these anecdotes, you see, they're important because they're disseminated in the gazettes. So whether they're true or not, is irrelevant. The fact is they are part of the public discourse. So the king thought that the dress was rather too fine. And you see the contrast between the two portraits. On the one hand, you have the writer fugitive on the left, and you would never know that the person is a writer, actually. And as you can see, he's sort of trying to hide from the spectator. And there's an attitude of reticence. He's reluctant to face the viewer. Whereas Hume, of course, is it is a portrait of the pensioned writer resting comfortably on his works. And so it's a very interesting depiction, very different from the the other portraits of Rousseau prior to this time. This is probably the most famous one from Latour. The original is lost, but copies were made from it. And this is a painting that was very much criticized by Diderot, who did not like this painting. And I want to say that there's an entire discourse at the time about the representations of writers. And usually writers are not happy with the portraits that are painted of them. And subsequently, what happens is that because Rousseau preferred this face of him, but the Armenian costume was the most famous representation, the two kind of get blended. And you see an example here, which is from Geneva. This is also, it shows that the portrait painted by Ramsay became very famous because it was engraved. Multiple copies were, and this is an engraving not made by the by Alan Ramsay's assistant in London, which then reappears, and I just want to show you this because Ben Franklin, when he comes to Paris in the 1770s, he is immediately, of course, every single major artist of the day wants to take his portrait, and they actually, Jean-Baptiste Nini, who's an Italian artist, takes the hat from Ramsay's portrait. So Rousseau's hat ends up on Benjamin Franklin, l'Américain. And Benjamin Franklin himself, by the way, if you read the newspapers and gazettes of the day, his entry in the salons in France is remarked is his appearance, in particular his hairstyle, the fact that he's not wearing the customary wig and powder of the day. And there's a quote here from Marie Antoinette's Lady-in-Waiting, who talks about, I like this quote, that Benjamin Franklin arrived in Paris with a costume of an American farmer. So here's what an American farmer looks like to the French. And then the Armenian costume has a whole history, which I don't have time to talk about now, but it's also associated with the genre of travel writing and also scientific writing. The Armenian costume is oriental, and it's foreign and it's exotic, so there's a whole dimension here. Another image of Rousseau, which at the end of his day, so just to show that there are contradictory and contemporary images. And then here, I've just added, just as a contrast, you see how Voltaire, for example, in a depiction of Voltaire and in his own construction of persona, Voltaire follows the aristocratic model. Voltaire, as you know, is not an aristocrat, but he is depicted as one. Diderot, who is also not an aristocrat and of the generation of Rousseau, is here depicted in a more traditional fashion for a man of letters, with the tool of his trade, the pen and the ink and the writings. And so if you contrast this to Rousseau, you see that Rousseau here, the portrait is not the portrait of a writer. It's a portrait of a fugitive, not of a writer. And I just wanted to show you also some of the iconography of the king. The king, and you'll see the headdress. And of course, you recognize from the New Orleans Saints, the lily there. And, so these are the sort of traditional portraits that allow you to see the evolution.